You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. I'm David Wessel. I'm director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy here at Brookings. And on behalf of our partners at the Olin Business School at Washington University in St. Louis, the Rosenberg Institute of Global Finance at Brandeis International Business School, and the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago, I want to welcome you to the 8th Annual Municipal Finance Conference. We have a particularly good set of papers and discussions planned for today. I just want to explain to you a little bit about how the day is going to work and tomorrow. As you can see, we're all gathered here for this session together in this room. And then if you look at your program, the next session will be two concurrent sessions, one in the auditorium just across the way here. If you have any problems with logistics, my colleagues from the Hutchins Center, there will always be someone at the desk outside who will be happy to help you. This conference is on the record. Some of the sessions will be live streamed. All the panels, this panel and the ones later in the day and tomorrow, two other panels, will be live streamed. So we don't have anybody with a camera to catch you if you're falling asleep. But if you ask a question, your friends and neighbors will know whether it was intelligent or not. And at the end of the day, we'll give you some information on logistics of how to get to the hotel where we have our dinner and the keynote interview with Dan Hines, Deputy Governor of the State of Illinois. We'll have a bus for people who want to take a bus. It's a brief walk, but it's probably 100 degrees out there already, so you might want to take the bus. We do have one favor. I want to thank the Advisory Committee for the Municipal Finance Conference, a group of people who have been very helpful to us, particularly in selecting papers from those that are presented and helping us find discussants and moderators. You'll meet some of them later today. We had a little lunch before this thing, and we were discussing ideas for making the conference even better and more relevant than it is already. And one of the ideas we had was we would greatly welcome ideas, particularly from practitioners, but from anybody, about topics that they wish academics would investigate, questions that they would like to have answered. So our suggestion is, if you have such a question, something you think we ought to look into, it can be broad, it can be narrow. If you just write it on a piece of paper and leave it with one of our colleagues at the front desk, we'll collect them and it'll help us in planning in the future. It'd be great if you list your name and email if you want to get in touch, if we want to get in touch with you, but if you don't want to do that, just a question is fine. So, because we desperately want to create rigorous research into questions that are of pressing import both to the markets and the public sector. So with that, I'd like to turn the podium over to Paulie Worthington from the Harris School at Chicago, who's going to be the moderator of the first panel on climate change and the state and local government.
Good afternoon. Thank you, David, for those remarks. Especially thank you for saying in full the names of all the co-sponsoring organizations. That saves me a little time here. Welcome to the 8th Annual Municipal Finance Conference here at Brookings. It is co-sponsored by the Hutchins Center, the Rosenberg Institute at Brandeis, and the Olin School at WashU, and of course the Harris School at the University of Chicago. My name is Paula Worthington, and I'm pleased to be moderating this kickoff session. In this session, we will hear about some recent work on the risks posed by climate change at a very localized level, with special attention on the fiscal consequences for those local communities which are heavily reliant on the coal sector for employment, wages, and public sector taxes and other revenues. How do we identify such communities and their local governments, many of whom have issued municipal-backed municipal debt backed either explicitly or implicitly by coal sector revenues. How much do municipal bond investors and other market participants understand the risks involved with these instruments? And how can such communities best prepare for a less carbon-intensive future? To set the stage, I'm pleased to introduce Noah Kaufman and Adele Morris, who will present their work, joint with Siddhi Doshi, on the risk of fiscal collapse in coal-reliant communities. Following their presentation, Matt Kahn will share his thoughts on municipal finance and climate change adaptation. After those presentations, I will invite each of our two panelists, Tim Coffin and Tommy Wells, to offer their own brief responses, and then I'll moderate a group discussion on the issues raised by this important work. And with that, I'd like to invite Noah up to the podium.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. It was real pleasure to work with Adele and Siddhi on this project, and it's very cool to be here today to get to talk to you all about it. It's not in our title, but the premise of the report is the risks of climate change and the need for policies to address those risks. Our sense was that it's pretty well understood that climate policy presents risks to the coal industry and in turn, the workers in the industry, and that corporations across a lot of different industries are facing demands from investors related to climate change risks. But a lot less attention has been paid to local governments, and in particular, the risks to coal-dependent local governments in the United States. So that is the sort of that's the void that our project attempts to start filling. So what I'm going to do is talk for the next few minutes just about where we are with coal in the United States and where we might be headed. And then I'm going to turn it over to Adele, who's going to talk about the dependence of governments on the industry and the implications. So the first thing to know is that the coal industry in the United States is small. About 50,000 workers are directly employed in coal mining today, but it's really geographically concentrated. So these bubbles here are where the mines are and sort of their relative size. 26 counties are classified as coal mining dependent, so that means at least 8% of the workforce are directly employed by the industry, and that's across 10 different states. We still produce and use a lot of coal in the United States. We are the second or third largest producer today behind China. 25% or so of electricity in the country is produced using coal. But as you can see on this figure here, over the last 10 years, production and use have both declined precipitously. And there's a lot of reasons for that decline, but by far the number one reason has been the fall in the price of natural gas. Natural gas is very cheap and very available, and as you can see here, coal use has declined and natural gas use has come up recently. So because it's been mostly market forces, that means, number one, it's not necessarily true that these trends are going to continue. And number two, looking backwards at least, this narrative that the government is killing the coal industry is kind of not true, right? However, when you look forwards, you really do have an existential risk of climate policy to the coal industry. Looking forwards is a different story, and that's the future that we focus on in our paper. So sort of as a proxy for what might be the potential impacts of climate policy on the coal industry, we use a scenario that the U.S. government produced. It's broadly similar to a lot of modeling efforts that have looked at this question. But they envision a price on carbon dioxide emissions, starts at $25 a ton in 2020. It's only on the power sector. And actually, a lot of the proposals you see in Congress are quite a bit more stringent. than this. And the purpose of the exercise isn't to be precise. It's to get a general sense of what the magnitude of the impacts might be. And that magnitude really is a collapse. So if you look at total coal production under this scenario over the next 10 years, a price like this causes a ton of coal to be twice, three times, four times more expensive. Electricity producers just can't keep using coal when they have low-cost alternatives like gas, solar, wind. So that's why you see this sort of fall off a cliff from a policy like this. And you can see under current policies, there's a decline, but it's nothing like what you would see in a climate policy scenario. And then the last point I'll make is that there isn't any region, coal-producing region in the country, that is immune to this these potential impacts. So this shows the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, which is actually hit hardest because of the type of coal they produce. In Appalachia, the story is, relatively speaking, a little better, at least in some parts. But we're still talking about a decline of, say, 50% off current levels. And for towns that are dependent on the coal industry, that's still a collapse they'll have to grapple with. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Adele.
Thanks very much, Noah. So then we want to translate these declines in coal production into what it's going to mean for the fiscal conditions in these coal-producing areas. It turns out this is actually a really hard thing to do, in part because there are so many diverse revenue instruments that are related directly or indirectly to coal production. And oftentimes in the data, they're not parsed out from other mineral production. And the flow of funds from these diverse revenue instruments is quite scattered and dependent on the state and complicated formulas for both the tax bases and the tax rates. Some cases, the revenue goes directly to a county government. Sometimes it goes to a state trust fund and gets merged with other funds and then eventually gets distributed out into a county government or some other sub-state jurisdiction. Sometimes it goes directly into a special district. And sometimes none of these is true. And what actually happens is the money goes to the state government and the state government picks up the tab for an expenditure category that would otherwise fall to the county. So really understanding one's exposure to coal in these local areas is quite difficult. And just to illustrate, this is a flow chart of funds for the Wyoming state government. There are four or five different revenue instruments that are heavily dependent on coal production, including the royalties from coal production on federal lands that lie within Wyoming, and the state equivalent of those, and severance taxes and lease bonuses. You add all this stuff up, even for one of those categories, like the federal royalties, it splays out into eight different revenue streams that then go to trust funds and back to local governments and doing different public service provisions. All told, there's probably at least 33 different revenue streams that come from coal-related revenue. Also, again, some of which were merged with revenue from oil and gas production. Really tough to figure out what your exposure is. And in actual fact, if you were trying to design a fiscal system that obscures your true exposure to the coal industry, it could look very much like this one right here. So there's no way to generalize from the coal production declines that Noah was talking about to fiscal conditions in these jurisdictions. So let's take some examples. So we went through the data of coal-reliant counties and picked three of them in three different states, Boone County, West Virginia, Campbell County, Wyoming, and Mercer County, North Dakota. So we could just see the differences in how this revenue works in the three different states. So you'd think now if we dig in, we can actually figure it out. Well, it's a lot harder than you would think. Even like, let's just take Boone County, West Virginia. This is an important example because they've already experienced the decline in coal production that have been projected in the modeling results that Noah just talked about. From 2012 to 2017, their coal production declined by 70%. They had 31 mines at the beginning of that period and 20 closed within that five-year period. And so that decline in coal revenue resulted in a 38% decline in the county government revenue. So that's a pretty large exposure, and that's not atypical, what we think is probably going to be the shape of things to come from other jurisdictions. So let's take a look at Campbell County, Wyoming. This is sort of another, this is one of those Powder River Basin coal-producing areas that shows the most plummeting decline in the modeling projections. You're trying to figure out, well, okay, exactly how much of the revenue comes from coal? Well, we know that about half the revenue comes from the property tax, is property and production tax, and about 59% of that tax base is coal. So that already tells you that's a lot of your property tax base. 21% of their sales, or no, 19% of their sales and use tax is related to minerals. 19% of their revenues from sales and use, and of that, 29% is minerals, but we don't know the composition of the minerals. But basically, suffice it to say, this is a very coal-exposed area. And then Mercer County, North Dakota, best we can do, figure it out, about half their revenue comes from coal. So this is a large exposure to a very potentially large loss. And what's happening is because these communities have these resources they can tax, their other tax rates are quite low. So, you know, diversifying their economy doesn't necessarily raise their tax revenue because those other activities are undertaxed. So, okay, those are the revenues directly tied to coal. What about what happens when coal declines and you see declines in the other parts of the ledger? So we looked at some examples. We looked at a coal example in South Wales, UK, and in other examples of concentrated industry collapse in the United States. And in most cases, what you see is this fiscal death spiral where public services decline, property values decline, other revenues decline, out-migration produces blight, and you really make a situation that's very difficult to come back from. We found one example in our work, Greenville, South Carolina, where they managed to get ahead of the fiscal problems and diversify their economy. They had some good fortune in having higher education entities nearby, and they made the most of it, and they pulled it off. But it by no means is certain in any other context, particularly coal, because when those coal mines close, they're left with a big hole in the ground that doesn't exactly invite investment. So now we wanted to know, well, what does this mean for the bond markets, the bonds that have been issued by these counties? So we looked at seven bonds from two of the counties in our exercise that I described earlier. They ranged from $3.5 million to $445 million, and they are coming due in that period where we think climate policy is going to be most impactful on the industry. We looked at the disclosure statements within there and really found there was very little effort to grapple with the risk to these bonds and to bondholders as a result of the decline in the fundamental tax base of these communities. And looking at the ratings agency's reports, we also found what I would call insufficient grappling with serious risks. So in conclusion, we'd like to say, first of all, these impacts are not a reason not to have climate policy. They're a reason to engage and anticipate the impacts of that policies to mitigate some of the downside risks that we're discussing. And we also argue that we should have much better transparent data to be able to ascertain the exposure to the industry. And I think we leave many questions for the stakeholders in the industry about what's the best way to go about properly accounting for those risks. And finally, while we have concentrated on the mining industry, there's an entire other set of entities and jurisdictions that are exposed throughout this industry. These are areas that are reliant on coal-fired power plants. And there is a very high likelihood that in some of these jurisdictions, the same fiscal issues are going to arise as the coal industry declines. Thank you.
Folks, good afternoon. I'm going to be speaking about climate change adaptation. And I have been working on this topic for a long time. My critics say too long. And the challenge of climate change adaptation revolves around, given that we have unleashed climate change, and given that we're risk-averse and want our children and grandchildren to have a good future, what steps do we take now to increase our resilience as individuals, as urbanites in the U.S. and around the world? And folks, my starting point today is that climate change adaptation requires new infrastructure investments. And I pose to you that right now there's a mismatch between the infrastructure we have, whether those are roads, airports, sewer systems, our electricity grid, and a flexible state-of-the-art infrastructure that would increase our resilience as individuals, firms, governments, and entities. And so what I'd like to speak to you about today, and I'm an economist, I'm not a civil engineer, I'm an economist. As an economist, I want to think about the incentives of the leaders of our cities to prioritize investments in climate-resilient infrastructure, and how do we pay for these? There are balanced budget constraints. So, folks, a couple of points. The urban capital stock is highly durable, and it lives a long time. John F. Kennedy Airport was not built yesterday. I was here last Monday giving a talk at the IMF and got very, very wet and was fascinated by this horrible case study of how was anyone's commute disrupted? And I'm fascinated by our resilience. For folks affected that day, did you just lose your morning or did you lose much more? And the counterfactual, if Washington, D.C. had a more absorptive infrastructure, would the morning and the aftermath have been easier? That's what I'm really talking about. And so we all know that for any piece of capital equipment, whether it's your air conditioner or your car, there's always a capital replacement cycle, and we tend to engage in deferred maintenance of delaying costly programs. If we're not, that makes us less ready for the punch of climate change if we don't invest in this preventative maintenance. But we face a political issue. Mayors are very powerful in making decisions over infrastructure. Do mayors have the right incentives to pursue these climate-resilient investments? Are mayors rewarded for having a long-term perspective? Or are they rewarded for short-termism? So here's a map of the U.S. And as an economist, what puzzles me in this slide is we see the areas that climate scientists predict may be at risk for future sea level rise, but we know that there's known unknowns here. We don't know how fast the sea level will rise and at what rate it actually will occur. And an optimistic mayor might just kick the can and say, my successor will handle this. And I forgot to mention, this is joint work with Rihanna Jurch, who I learned so much from her. And folks, this project is up and going, but this is very much a work in progress. And so please get in touch with me to make our paper more resilient. Different cities face different challenges for them to be resilient based on their geography and their historical circumstances. And I think there's many interesting case studies for thinking through the different challenges and different investments that different cities can make. Each of these require real money, and there's a question of how to tap into the finances to finance these investments. The challenge of infrastructure upgrades revolves around the fact, and Brookings research has studied this, that much of the money has to be state and local money. And when you begin to think about the options for how to fund these, issuing debt and issuing municipal bonds is one potentially politically palatable way to go about raising such funds relative to perhaps more salient, less attractive features to a politician, such as raising taxes or local user fees. And we can discuss this, but it's sort of common sense that bonds could be an attractive option for raising such funds. Folks, a piece of economic history for folks who are already getting bored with me. David Cutler and Grant Miller wrote a great paper now 15 years ago. Back in the 1930s, the United States faced a major water pollution challenge. Our major cities had very high population density, and infectious disease was spreading, typhoid, cholera. What David and Grant document in their paper, Water, Water Everywhere, was the ability back in the 1930s, the development of the municipal finance such that cities could sell debt, raise the money to then pay the engineers to do the projects that then sharply reduced the water pollution challenges in our cities. And I think that that's a terrific piece of economic history. Folks, I want to make some points about the bond rating agencies, and I'm very excited that the other members of the session are not academics and are practitioners out there in the real world. In my work on climate change adaptation, I've run into many critics who have said, Matt, the typical mayor, what I mean by behavioral in my slide here is mayors may be, some might be climate deniers, some might be myopic and saying that I have a 5-year horizon, not a 30-year horizon. Some may be underestimating the risks of that their cities might face. I've been very interested by my line of who is the adult in the room. If there's decision makers who are underestimating certain risks that the municipal bond rating agencies, Moody's and S&P and Fitch, can play this role of disciplining leaders who don't step up. But for the ratings agencies to play this role, they need to have the human capital and the expertise to know when a city has underinvested in certain resilience. And that's actually very difficult to know. So, folks, point number two here. Will the rating agencies punish cities who do not take adequate precautions? Folks, what's awkward in this bullet point is how do we know it when we see it? If I tell you that Boston or Baltimore is spending $1 million on retrofitting its water treatment facilities, is that a lot or a little? In a production function sense, if you spend an extra $1 million on water treatment, do you reduce the risk by 1%, by 2%? These are key parameters for thinking about. Folks, remember the joy of your Econ 101 class when your professors drew marginal benefit and marginal cost curves. Folks, can everyone draw with me? How do we make those curves in this key case? So your professor was happy to draw those curves, but how do we do this here? And yet it's essential for knowing whether we have invested like Goldilocks. Have we underinvested? Have we overinvested? Or have we invested the right amount? For the rating agencies to play the possible role of being the adult in the room, they will have to have the expertise, the manpower and womanpower on their payroll to evaluate whether a city, given its current infrastructure and given its topography, if it has underinvested in infrastructure, it saves money in the short run, but it's exposing itself to fat tail, Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans type risk. If it's the case that if a city at risk from a fat tail climate event would suffer a downgrade of all of its bond issuance and face higher interest rates on all of its outstanding debt and future debt, that begins to wake up local leaders to begin to prioritize this issue. I am very interested in the role of human capital as a force in helping us to adapt to climate change. If there's increased financing for mega projects to update our infrastructure, to have a 21st century infrastructure, then this will create a profit motive and more talent will actually move into the urban resilience field. More young people will specialize their human capital in fields related to flood protection and other infrastructure, and the field of civil engineering will accelerate because of this increased access to finance. And so the finance channel creates a mechanism for facilitating the development of the resilience market, helping us to adapt. Folks, my final questions. Two slides left. Gonna give back 2 minutes to society. Rihanna and I, as economists, have asked some cynical questions, and I apologize. Cities will be more likely to underinvest in self-protection if there's an anticipation of generous ex post federal bailouts. Something that interests both of us very much is, does moral hazard matter in climate change adaptation? Does the anticipation of ex post bailouts crowd out ex ante self-protection? And I think this needs to be discussed. As a public finance economist, the second bullet point, for those cities that upgrade their infrastructure, will real estate prices go up in those cities? When Jeff Bezos was evaluating different HQ2 locations, did he and his team of nerds take into account the climate risks that each location faced? For those that did not win the two headquarters, was it a factor that Bezos and the nerds could not calculate the risk or were worried about those risks? For those cities that raise their game on climate change adaptation, will they attract the unicorns and other companies? If that's the case, then we get a race to the top. And even climate-denying mayors will notice they're not obtaining job starts. They're not attracting the HQ2s and will raise their game and will have a virtuous circle there of attracting talent. So, folks, what Rihanna and I are up to in our project is we are taking a look at which cities are investing in sea level rise adaptation. There's a spatial mismatch here that cities with high predicted sea level rise, are they taking adaptive investments? We're interested in what factors limit the propensity to take these investments. If politicians are mostly rewarded ex post for how they attract disaster aid after a disaster, those politicians won't be so aggressive of taking ex-ante action. Is it only larger cities that are taking these actions because they're scale economies? For those cities that have bad credit ratings and thus face a higher interest rate for borrowing, do they underinvest in municipal resilient capital? That would be a great shame, because that would say that climate change will increase inequality across cities if the poorest cities with the worst ratings can't get money to finance infrastructure to protect themselves. And so, folks, on that note, I'm looking forward to our panel. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And so I'm going to introduce myself quickly and offer a few comments. I'm part of the panel, so I'm not presenting anything new. So it's nice to see everybody. My name is Tim Coffin. I'm with Breckenridge Capital Advisors. We're a fixed income manager in Boston. And we manage a little over $33, $34 billion worth of municipal bonds. And to put that into perspective, we're buying anywhere between 200 to 400 million bonds a week in the marketplace. So that's just to kind of give you a foundation from where we come from. And it does make us one of the larger investors in the market. I took some notes through all the comments, and I just wanted to kind of address some of them, so I have to refer to them a little bit. And kind of my beginning note was I tried to break them into kind of the why. And Matt or Matthew, your comment about the known unknowns. If you understand this, we're hired by clients to manage investment grade, resilient, predictable bond portfolios that act as a counterbalance to risk to their other assets. And so when you start talking about things like known unknowns, right, we don't know when sea level rise is coming. We don't know how much sea level will rise. That's what risk is. And so if we're in the business of risk mitigation, we have to take that sort of, we have to try and get that more holistic, forward-looking view. So from a why standpoint, climate risk may be in the markets relatively new, but the reason that climate risk or the reasons that climate risk are so material to investors have actually been around forever, all right? So number one, so I'm going to speak specifically to your paper, Adele and Noah, you know, and that is kind of legacy, concentration in taxpayer base or employers, right? So that is something that any credit analyst is going to look for as a vulnerability. Number two, legacy or non-performing assets, right? So these are actually tremendously large assets within the area, but even things like parking garages or convention centers and factors like that, those are factors that we look at from an essentiality standpoint. So number three, I would say essentiality, and this points a little bit to some of the examples of credits that you brought up. So solid waste, rural hospitals, pollution control, IDBs, those are all kind of further down the essentiality of public purpose. And so a lot of this discussion and what connects your comments with Matthew's comments really is, you know, one of the starting points for creditors is how essential is the public purpose? Because communities stand behind their K through 12 education before they do a convention center in times of kind of fiscal distress. And so essentiality of public purpose is a key why. Now, I would add to Matthew's whole question of how do you get municipalities to make the commitment to finance this type of client adaptation or resiliency, you really need to win the essentiality argument. You need to go and be able to say to taxpayers and to voters that this is more important than a new convention center or a new runway or, in some cases, new schools. And so it really begins, and any of the debt issuers in the room would tell you this, it actually begins at the capital budgeting process. That's really where you need to start when you're talking about building adaptation, building resiliency. So very quickly, just from the why standpoint, and I think this matters because I think the adult in the room is the market, right? That, you know, these things may be 10, 20, 25-year problems, but the market can pick up on them much sooner, right? I mean, the insurance markets and the real estate markets already may be, and so there's no reason why the bond market, particularly with the rating agencies paying attention, can't start reacting more quickly. So there's the how. What do investors do? How do we integrate these factors into our fundamental credit research? So Breckenridge, like other bond managers, we started back as far back now in 2011 is when we formally started integrating environmental, social, and governance metrics into our overall research. We have bought a lot of data. We had an organization called Climate Central build us an index that uses population at risk as a proxy for risk from sea level rise, for the obvious reasons that the property taxes that back the bonds that we buy in coastal communities are backed by those property taxes that could potentially be underwater or treated as such in the marketplace. But increasingly, we also care about things like fire, heat, wind, excess rainfall, drought vulnerability, all those factors. And the reality is that data is out there right now. There are organizations out there who have been providing it to insurance companies and manufacturers and things that can really give us that information right down to the square mile. The paper mentions TCFD, which is the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosure. Breckenridge is a signatory to TCFD, and we'll actually report to TCFD in our own CSR this year. And it is an effort to really standardize the type of disclosure to make it more widely reported and more standardized makes it easier for investors to really disseminate it and to weight it properly on a sector-by-sector basis. So whether it's water and sewer authorities or airports or higher education or cities and towns. But there's some other organizations out there also, and I don't think I saw this in your paper, but CDP, the Carbon Disclosure Project, actually has excellent guidance for cities, really with the intention of providing, again, kind of this uniform platform for reporting. Reporting is an issue, and reporting is a struggle for municipalities. Interestingly, an important part of our exercise has been engagement. And so we do engage both with companies and municipalities, and we've discovered, even though we carry a pretty big stick in the muni market, that it's hard to engage with municipalities, and it's just because they don't have the bandwidth. The city of New York, the state of California, we can get their sustainability officers on the phone, but you know, some regional school district around, it's a little bit harder to do. And then lastly, I would point you to C40 and also Ceres and some of their work on green infrastructure. So that gives you a little perspective from how we view it from a risk mitigation standpoint and just a very, very, very high-level overview of how we actually go about integrating this into our research.
Great. Thank you.
Do I stay up here?
Mr. Wells, say a couple words, sure, and then we'll convene as a panel and go at it.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Tommy Wells, and I do live in a different space from the rest of the presenters in that I have to prepare the city for climate change and meet the expectations of the residents that we are doing something about mitigating climate change. So I'm the director of the Department of Energy and Environment for the city, Washington, D.C., 700,000 people, and certainly a city that has a lot of the challenges that any of the older cities in the East Coast cities have. So in responding to both papers, the first one is about coal. So D.C. is a consumer. We don't produce energy from D.C. anymore. We used to, but we don't have power plants in D.C., so we're a consumer. Our power company, Pepco Exelon, can only distribute power, so we purchase it through the PJM auction and markets. And so we influence that as a consumer by we require a renewable portfolio standard. And we just adopted a law that says that we're to get to 100% renewables by renewable portfolio standard by 2032 and to have the city be 100% carbon neutral by 2050. Cities are doing this all across America, that there's a mayor's pledge to agree that we are going to get to carbon neutral generally by 2050. And so we just passed a law that creates the first building energy performance standards, that our buildings have to use less energy. And if they don't meet those standards in 5 years, we will fine them. And we've created a lot of instruments to help them get there. And that's new. We're the first ones to do it. New York just did it, and it'll catch on across the country. That's not just the incentives, because we'll come back to that, where natural gas has lowered the cost of energy in the city. So there's not a whole lot of incentive to save as much energy. So now we're going to do that with a stick through the building energy performance standards. So since measuring to the Bloomberg standards through C40, we've reduced our greenhouse gases caused by DC by 28% since 2006. That's primarily shifting from purchasing energy that's generated through natural gas from coal. Also, we have reduced the amount of electricity used by our commercial sector, our buildings, by 3% over that period of time, even though we've had a historic record of amount of construction, as you know, in D.C. since World War II. So there's no question our goals are clear. As consumers of energy, we want to reduce our carbon footprint. We want to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, and we'll band together with other cities to do that to impact the market as much as we can. The second thing is, in terms of resiliency, last year when the mayor was in New York making a pitch about our bond ratings, that is the first time that I got a call saying, quickly, where's our resiliency plans? Moody's wants to know. And we quickly showed that we had a resiliency plan. And it's clear that when you borrow money for infrastructure, people would like to know, is that infrastructure going to be washed away? And so at any given time. So I'll say that quickly that our greatest challenge is sea level rise. We're a tidal city. We were on two rivers, so it's river surges, but then it's storm events. We had a storm event last Monday that was a record amount of rain, and it rains in the city. So when you look at resiliency, usually you think of how do you keep your rivers from flooding into your city, and how do you prevent sea level rise from impacting your city. But now there's so many storm events. We had something called a derecho not long ago that we had never heard of that before. But the amount of energy and rain and water that's going into the city means that you have to change how you create resiliency. Say quickly on our capital funds that the mayor for the first time put $5 million, which is a lot for us, on capital funds to just do flood modeling for the city, just for flood modeling. The other is that apparently we don't have enough people in the city, so I'm also the chair of D.C. Water and Sewer Authority. And what some of you know is that we have a combined sewer overflow issue that other cities have, and that the tunnels work as rain barrels for us, that we're tunneling the size of metro stations or metro tunnels, and we just opened up our first 7 miles of that. But that's going to be about $3 billion. And we did one of the first Green Century bonds for $350 million to help fund it. And the theory is that there will be taxpayers here for the next 100 years benefiting from that investment, and they can pay for it too, rather than doing it on just the 30-year investment schedule. So thank you.
Continue this discussion. So, terrific presentations and comments and feedback so far.
Thank you. Better now with the audio? Great. So very nice work that we heard about. I thought I would just kick it off by asking, I guess this is a question to start with for Matt. but then see where it goes. And I wanted to follow up on the ex post, ex ante issue you raised, moral hazard problem. We do have a lot of government programs that provide emergency assistance to affected communities in the aftermath of natural disasters. How should we think about adjusting those programs in a way that limits the moral hazard problem and incentivizes local governments to invest proactively in resilience?
So I've been very interested in the work of Carolyn Kowski and other economists who, my read of their work is that several of the federal programs are not as generous as some might think they are. And so I don't fully know the answer to that question, but I think something we learned in 2008 is the importance of having skidded the game to encourage asset owners to take actions to this preventative care. And I think this time consistency issue is very frustrating to me as an economist, that we want to tell entities, we're not going to bail you out. You're on your own. You know, eat your spinach. But it's human nature and it's politics also after a disaster to be compassionate. And so I think very interesting issues will arise. If the private, Paul, one last thought. If the private sector could play a role here, the great economist Dwight Jaffe asked the question, why is the federal government involved in insurance? When could the private sector on its own handle insurance? And he was writing after the terrorist attacks of 9/11 of whether there could be catastrophic insurance. And I think that this issue will arise more. So perhaps now I know the answer. If the private sector were to step up here and we had private catastrophic insurance, that might take away some of the necessity of existing government programs to step in as a public insurer.
Great. Thank you. Any other thoughts on that from other panelists?
Cities don't have a choice. Cities don't have a choice. You know, Miami's having to raise their roads. Charleston's flooding almost daily now, and we've certainly seen what's happened in New Orleans, that we're on notice whether, your governor believes in climate change or not being impacted by human behavior. The mayors that have to protect cities have to find the investments in order to protect their assets.
Right. I have a different question for Noah and Adele.
Can I just add one little comment? Please. There is also, if you don't mind. Sorry, I'll be very quick. When you talk about kind of the moral hazard, if the government is subsidizing insurance on coastal properties, that's typically pretty affluent real estate, right? So there's a moral compromise there as well, right? If you're going along oceanfront property in New Jersey and the government is subsidizing that insurance, isn't that an issue? And that's not going to last, right? I mean, neither side of the ideological debate can really support that for long.
So my next question for Noah and Adele is concerning the possibility that the federal government obtain and direct significant resources towards these coal-reliant communities and their residents. What kind of source might there be for those revenues, and should those revenues be distributed conditional on some kind of agreements or behavioral commitments on the part of the receiving jurisdictions?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for that question. So the question is motivated by the fact that if we have climate policy, even modest policies that you saw modeled here, coal-reliant areas are under tremendous pressure. Now, that same pressure could arise from a system of state and local policy measures. It doesn't have to be a federal carbon price. It could be, you know, a collection of jurisdictions doing just exactly what Tommy Wells was describing DC is doing. Or it could be regulation under the Clean Air Act. The thing is, those other approaches don't raise any revenue that can then be siphoned off to help coal-reliant areas. So my advice to the policymakers in coal country is to not just, you know, keep your head in the sand. These problems aren't going to go away. Better to engage in a policy process that encourages an outcome where there are resources to help them with the dislocation they're going to experience. So, for example, let's say we had an economy-wide carbon tax on the order of $25 per ton of CO2 going up a few percentage points over inflation each year. We would score that out probably about $1 trillion over the first 10 years in revenue, only a small fraction of which you would need to go back to these local communities. And it's not just for the fiscal replacement. It's going to be pension and health care benefits for the workers. Probably some mine reclamation liabilities are going to land in the laps of some of these taxpayers. There are a whole host of workforce and other needs in these communities. And so I think the next step for my research is to try to figure out, well, what's the right agenda for that assistance and what are the best policies to produce those resources?
Yeah, and this was probably obvious from Adele's presentation, but if these, it's not that these counties or municipalities don't have a role to play in this also, it's just that a lot of them are struggling already. Right. There, a lot of them are already in this downturn, and they, even if they're sort of wanting to do the right thing and not putting their head in the sand, realistically, the degree of investments that are going to be needed probably does have to come from an outside source in the federal government, and something like a carbon price just makes all the sense in the world.
Thoughts from others on the panel on that? All right. Well, I have another question. This should be a softball question for Tommy. Most of the time when we talk about resiliency and adaptation in the context of cities and urban areas and all the infrastructure needs, we're talking about things. But really, cities and governments exist to serve the needs of people. And so I wondered if Tommy, you had some thoughts about how the most vulnerable segments of our population who are in our cities and urban areas are going to be affected by climate change and what the future looks like for them under the kinds of things you're doing in
D.C.
That's
a great question. It's a great question. And then when we made our proposal to be part of the 100 resilient cities that we put in the proposal, the impact of individuals on vulnerable populations, not just on the infrastructure. And so currently, when there's a heat event in the city or the power goes out on a really hot day, what we do is we move a bunch of metro buses to a neighborhood and we open up if we can, if we can get a rec center or something open. If not, we move a bunch of buses over there, turn the air conditioning on, people can go into the buses. It's not very elegant, not very, it's pretty crude. And we also know that in the most vulnerable parts of Washington that many of our residents don't have bank accounts. The resiliency plan for almost everyone here is probably the credit card in your wallet. We have certainly large communities, numbers of people that do not have credit cards. They don't have that kind of resiliency. So we also determined that we put a lot of affordable housing in an area called Watts Branch, and that is a flood zone. And that is, enticed a lot of people to live in one neighborhood, and now with the rising sea level rise, and Anacostia River is a tidal river, so it'll either happen through sea level storm surge or through rain, that we have a vulnerable neighborhood. So the planning that we're doing in working with neighbors is figuring out what the natural centers are there, whether it be churches or other government buildings, creating resiliency hubs, working with PEPCO as well to figure out how to have resiliency hubs that we can keep the power on, keep medicines chilled, and also provide water and support to folks in different parts of that neighborhood. But that's the intensity of the planning right now is just what you said, is that we have vulnerable populations, and we know that in climate change we're going to have extreme periods of heat, and we're going to also have flooding. And so we're preparing those neighborhoods for those two events.
To pick up on Tommy's remarks, There's very interesting work going on, an academic paper out of Miami, that you can identify higher ground in cities like Miami. And what's being seen is that home prices in such higher ground areas are differentially rising. And under the banner of climate gentrification, this means that poor renters in those areas are going to get priced out. And so building on Paula's question, I think there's a second discussion to be had on changes in land use. If climate nerds can identify higher ground and relatively safer places in our cities, this is another reason to change our zoning code to upzone in such areas. There's a discussion in this country, I'm looking at the young people in this room, about a housing affordability in our most productive cities. Yes. And this challenge that where demand is highest, supply is most constricted. And from the laws of supply and demand, that's very high rents, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Seattle, Portland. And we will be better able to protect the poor. The poor face the greatest challenges of adapting to climate change. And I think we, in this era of being very concerned about inequality, I think that this will become an even more central issue. It would be horrible if climate change further increased inequality and quality of life among us. So I think addressing these issues through public policy is essential.
And just to mention, of course, there's also concerns in terms of climate change policies and their effects on low-income households, particularly if you're going to be, addressing, fossil fuels are pretty cheap. And if you stop using fossil fuels to produce energy, that makes energy bills go up. Low-income households spend a larger proportion of their income on energy than anyone else. So, we do have to design our policies with that in mind also, and it's a solvable problem. And I'll be a broken record and mention something like a carbon price again, because if you have the revenue, you can deal with this problem. But certainly something to be aware of when you're designing mitigation policies also.
One last opportunity for panelists and speakers to engage directly, present questions to one another. And then I'd like to have a few minutes to invite questions from the audience. So anything
I'll just say in terms of the amount of funds that we need to retrofit the city, one of the things that we're having to rethink, especially in D.C., is how we move water around the city. If we're going to rebuild a park, should we go ahead and just drop it down 3 or 4 feet so that it can retain water in a storm event? Looking at where the canals used to be in Washington, do we need to figure out better how to channel water through those streets back into the rivers when you have the storm events within the city? And with that infrastructure, we're not used to funding that kind of infrastructure. We're working with Copenhagen and some other cities that are doing this, but it's a different way to think about how we move water through a city that we're not. We had a national weather alert, which means that there's a threat to person and property for the first time in the history of the city last Monday. And we have a different challenge now to protect our residents. And again, that was water that dropped on the city and didn't come from our banks. So thinking about how we're going to live with water, how we're going to move it through the city, and how we're going to pay for it is a new challenge for us.
Tim?
I would just say, and maybe this is an idea for another paper, but as investors increasingly take this more holistic view of credit risk to include things like climate resiliency, understand that they're also looking at social factors as well. And is the kind of the separation of economic and social progress, what are the credit implications for that? And so investors are looking at things like inclusiveness and tolerance and access to healthcare and basic human needs, the same way they're looking at environmental factors as well, just getting that longer-term focus.
Great. So I think I'd like to invite questions and comments from the audience. I believe we have someone with a mic here, and it's a gentleman here.
Hi. One of the things that concerns me that fits with all of this, I think, is what is the federal role going to be, and witness that in an environment where we're already starting to see some of these issues, climate change and technological change, that state and local governments need to respond to, and yet issuance, municipal bond issuance this year, is flat to down slightly. state and local governments are not responding. I think it's going to need a federal role. It's going to need a role based on carbon tax, I suspect, and then ways to disburse those revenues that come out of that. So I was wondering what thoughts anybody has on that.
Well, I would just say there have been a number of proposals in Congress to price carbon through a tax or a fee, and different versions of how that revenue might be used in that legislation. And there, in fact, there was a bill last year that was purely sponsored by Republicans in the House that would have put a carbon tax across fossil fuels in the U.S. economy. And one of the things that they targeted the revenue to was local investment in climate resilient investments. So we've already started to see that conversation happening, and I'm pretty convinced that bringing local governments to that conversation and trying to understand, well, what could be in it for me can, you know, be one small element in breaking the logjam of progress on climate policy. Certainly it's going to be a lot of wheels spinning for that deal, but I think it should be part of that conversation.
How organized are we at thinking about the ways in which one locality dealing with the flow of water through that locality is going to affect the localities around it? So if I'm Chatham dealing with water, I'm going to affect all the cities around Chatham, towns around Chatham as well. Are we organized at thinking about that at all?
So this is a fantastic question. In a hippie world, we would all work together and coordinate. A Kosian might say that those who suffer the most will make a side payment if someone upstream underinvests, will a downstream neighbor compensate them? My co-author, Rihanna Jurch, her thesis was on building on your point that there's a role for the federal government if localities on their own ignore strategic spillovers. And so you're absolutely right here. To really answer your question, we'd have to fully understand the civil engineering here of if you don't spend this $1 billion, what trickles down to a neighbor? And the faster we figure that out, the faster we can get to an efficient solution. But I'm looking for a civil engineer in the room. That strikes me as a hard problem.
Dan, I would just add to that, I mean, in the municipal finance world, there are solutions such as water districts, watershed districts, pollution control, clean water districts. So, the localities have figured it out in the past. So I think that might be a model. Why couldn't you have a climate resiliency district, right? Does that make sense?
Well, the best example right now would be the Chesapeake Bay Commission. There's nine states that are part of the watershed. And we've made a lot of progress, but there is a federal role to help fund and pull us together to reduce the amount of nutrients that we're putting into the bay. Now, some states are doing better than others, and getting like Pennsylvania to really care about Chesapeake Bay and change their infrastructure has been very difficult, including New York, but they're part of the Chesapeake Bay watershed. But there has been a lot of progress made as well.
So I have a silly question on the carbon tax and the coal paper. I was amazed to see the dramatic reduction in economic activity in coal. And so silly question, is a successful carbon tax is self-eliminating. And so policymakers need to kind of think about how the revenue stream gets spent in a way that either targets that community itself and doesn't roam elsewhere so that they are resilient and sustainable for the future as they get out of the activity that's being taxed. Any thoughts on that?
Sure. So it's absolutely true that a carbon tax changes the relative price of different fossil fuels according to their carbon content. And coal has twice as much carbon per unit of energy than natural gas. And therefore, when we price carbon, we see a much greater after-tax price increase in coal than we would in
natural gas and certainly renewables wouldn't be affected. So what happens is a tremendous amount of substitution away from coal, both because it's carbon intensive and because it has so many low-cost substitutes in its market. We'd probably see less substitution in the short run out of oil and gas because they just tend to be less elastic to the price signal. Eventually, though, you're right that, you know, we decarbonize the economy, the tax base goes away. But according to our modeling projections, that doesn't happen for 3 or 4 decades. As long as your tax rate goes up over inflation by several percentage points, your tax rate rises enough to compensate for the tax base shrinking. But eventually, yes, the carbon tax is not a permanent revenue source once you've more significantly decarbonized the economy. And those revenues don't naturally go to state or local governments. A federal carbon tax would be federal revenue. So it would be a matter for the state and local governments to figure out how they can get in the policy discussion around what happens to the revenue that's generated.
So I think we have time for one more question. So looks like we've got a question over here. Just a moment. We'll get a mic for you.
Sure. It's more of a question of on the coal paper. If you looked at kind of layered events, right? The one interesting thing about coal is it happens to also occur in states that are going to be a net increase of natural gas, right? So if we're moving from coal and mostly into natural gas, there should be a net positive increase in natural gas sales. At least that's the hope. West Virginia and the Marcellus Shale being the most particular. Did you do any work, or have you thought about especially on the state level where you said some of the money gets sucked, into the state coffers, for almost that's going to be a natural replacement to then trickle down, hopefully, and then go back to Boone County, who really desperately does need it for training and stuff.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I mean, the short answer is no. We didn't do analysis of the sort of offsetting effects there from the work, separate work that's been done. I'd say, natural gas certainly comes in the short term to replace coal under climate policy. But this isn't like we're not talking about a boon for natural gas because it's also a fossil fuel that is being affected by the climate policy. And particularly once you get rid of the coal, the next step is to address the natural gas. So I do think you're right that there could be, at least at the state level, some sort of offsetting revenue effects there. But I certainly don't think it's a long-term solution.
If you're interested in the modeling results across the economy on different fuel sectors and the macroeconomy, last year I co-chaired a major multi-model analysis through Stanford Energy Modeling Forum, and we had a special issue out on climate change economics where we had 11 different modeling groups run carbon price scenarios in the United States, and we go through in great detail what those models project as far as the energy sector outcomes and other outcomes of interest.
Great. Thank you very much for wonderful presentations and discussions and commentary, feedback from the audience. And now David's going to set us straight.
Sure. Thank you all. It was a great conversation. I think we've only touch the surface of something which is actually rather frightening when you think about its dimensions. So we're a little bit behind schedule, so I'm going to propose we take a 12-minute break and assemble at 10 minutes to 3. One session will be in here. This is two papers on state and local pensions. And the other session will be in the Saul Zilker room on the other side of the corridor on local government defaults and big data government economic monitoring. I should have noted earlier that all the drafts of all the papers and eventually the slides will be posted on, the paper's already there on our website if you want to see them in more detail, as will the videos from the panels. And also, it would be helpful to us if at the end of the day you held on to your name tag. And if you're coming tomorrow, bring it back so we can have a more efficient carbon reducing thing. So with that, please join me in thanking the panel and Paula for the moderation.